Parshat Chukat, Perek Kaf, Pasuk Aleph. And we'll see if at some point the sources materialize. So this is one of these unfortunate sections in the Torah. I was actually asked by one of these, like, funny, I don't know if it's a newspaper or not, but they asked different questions of different people. So they asked me a question: if you can go back and warn somebody in history about something that would happen, who would you warn, and what would the warning be? So, of course, most people this morning, it was published this morning, most people ignored what I said, and the main complaint was that there weren't any women who were asked about this. Not that I know who's going to be asked and who's not going to be asked, but so somebody said, there's never women there, which is not really true, because the last three times I was asked, there were women there. So how am I supposed to, again, anticipate who's going to be there and who's not going to be there? But for that matter, if I would already address this, should I also ask them how many Ashkenazim and how many Sephardim and how many Hasidim and how many Misnagdim and how many Ethiopians and how many... I don't know exactly, what I am supposed to do in order to make sure that everything is completely politically correct in terms of the response. And the truth is, I'm sympathetic to every one of the positions. But probably my mistake was actually answering. I guess that's the mistake. So I will try to correct that. But one of the things that you could have had as a possible response, by the way, my answer was I would have warned Eve to stay away from a fruit diet and to stick to an animal-based diet. It's much better long-term for health. That would have been my answer. And maybe to have, if a little more selfish, to have... told my father to buy some internet stock years ago. So just, a lot of good could have come from that. But one of the things that, people think about is, warn Moshe not to send the Meraglim or it was interesting because I taught a class in ethics this year, and I actually opened up the question to my students, and I let them try to come up with a response. And a number of them try to play with some kind of warning regarding the Holocaust. Exactly who and how and when is not all that simple. But one of the candidates over here should be Moshe, don't hit the rock. Right? That could have been... I guess that really what we're trying to say then is that here is an incredibly important moment of something unfortunate that took place. And because of this thing that took place, the consequences are just absolutely immense. So maybe we don't appreciate how immense, but the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu is not going to accompany us in Eretz Israel, so that is something which, even though we don't necessarily know the details, that's something which would seem to have great implications. So we're going to start with that, and we'll see how far we can get from this. And let's try to read carefully. Vayavo b'nei Yisrael kol ha'eda midbar tzin. Now, the phrase eda has been used in the past. It's always interesting to try to note when the word eda is used and when the word kahal is used and other possible uses as well, or terms as well. V'yavo b'nei Yisrael kol eda midbar tzin b'chodesh harishon. Now, one of the things that we're told, perek kaf b'midbar perek kaf pasuk aleph. Now, one of the things that we're told over here as a comment on this verse is that this is the end of the years in the desert. We have just now jumped 39 years, and now we're already in the 40th year. Everyone's arrived. V'yeshiv ha'am. Now notice we went from B'nai Yisrael to Eda to Am. V'yeshiv ha'am b'Kadesh. So it's also interesting the place is called Kadesh. When we get to the end of the section, then we suspect that the reason it's called Kadesh is because of things that will take place here. And when they arrived there, it was not necessarily called Kadesh. This is only a retrospective. V'tamat sham Miriam. And Miriam died, v'tikaver sham. V'liyamayim le'ida, and the people didn't have water. V'yikalu al Moshe v'al Haron. And they gathered upon Moshe and Aaron. And this is what leads us to the conclusion that the water that they did have in the desert was in the merit of Miriam, because Miriam dies and then there's no water. So obviously when Miriam's alive, there is water. And there's many things to talk about in terms of Miriam and water along the way, be it when she sees Moshe, right, when she goes down to the river. Later on, after the splitting of the sea, we find Miriam. We find Miriam in water occasions. So over here, again, with Miriam's death, there is no water. V'yarev ha'am im Moshe. The people quarrel with Moshe. V'yomru le'mor, and they say, V'lu gavanu b'gva achinu lefnei Hashem. Had we only perished together with our brothers in front of God. Now, we've had so many complaints in the desert that I think that we just tend to lump them all together and say that they're all the same, and we look at them all the same. One of the reasons that over here we should be a little bit more careful is because we're not dealing with the same generation. We're dealing with the next generation. So is this simply a case that the new generation has inherited the previous generation's complaining capacity? You know, is this one of these moments that we realize that, you know, we've become our parents, or we realize that we've raised children who pick up not just perhaps our good parts, but also our bad parts? But over here, the complaining of the previous generation seems to have been inherited. But there are some things over here, and you see that I bolded Lefnei. Oh, you don't see it. You can't see. You can't see what I've bolded now. Okay, without your sources. So I guess the regular Chumash doesn't bold what I like them to bold. Okay. So over here it says that if we only died in front of God, Lefnei Hashem. So the first thing that I want to point out is that God is within their, not just vocabulary, within their consciousness. That here you have people who have a God consciousness, and they're saying, had we only died in front of God? Which leads us then to begin to question, who are they referring to? Which means, till this point, a bunch of people have died in the desert. Who is it that they are referring to? Or which previous episode is in their minds when they say this? So I want to, I mean, just think for a moment. We had a couple of weeks ago the Mapilim, the people who go rush up and they go, and right? They're not killed Lefnei Hashem. So who is it who's called Lefnei Hashem? So I think that actually your best candidate will be a group from last week's Parsha, and that will be the 250 people who were the fake Kohanim who tried to bring the Torah and they died in front of God, which also is the same term which is used by Nadav and Avihu. So that itself is very interesting, and I just want to couple on top of that is that they died in front of holiness, and over here this place is going to be called Kadesh. So there is something over here, just the way that this is presented, that should cause us, you know, to pause a moment and say, no, this is not the same as every single complaint that we've had till now. And then they continue with what they have to say. V'lama evetim et kal Hashem. They say, why have you brought the congregation of God? So when I said before that there was God consciousness, again, yes, there is indeed God consciousness over here, despite the fact that we're about to hear a complaint. V'lama evetim et kal Hashem ela midbar hazeh. Why have you brought us to this place? Lamut sham anachnu v'arenu. That we and our flock are going to die. That you've brought us to a place which is not Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash, which was essentially your mandate, and that's what you said you were going to do. So this complaint is, yes, they just now complained, why did you take us out of Egypt? But they're saying, why did you take us out of Egypt to come here? And you all hear, maybe, what is here between the lines. Why haven't you taken us to this place that you're supposed to take us to? Why have you taken us to Israel? And it's as if they're saying, we are the people of God. Why have you taken us to the land of God? So therefore, in a sense, this is indeed an attack on Moshe, but it's not the same kind of attack that we've had before. There is something really different about this. V'yavo Moshe v'Aaron m'pnei ha'kahal. They came from in front of these people, ha'petach ha'omoid, v'yplu ha'pneihem, v'yeira, Kvod Hashem Elokechem, and then there is this epiphany, and God appears. V'dibir Hashem Moshe Lemor. So even though that they came to complain in front of Moshe and Aaron, and Moshe and Aaron come in front of God, God speaks to Moshe, and he says, Kach et mateh. Now the question over here, of course, is which mateh, because we have two that candidates. One will be Moshe's old time mateh, which we have not seen in a very long time, and the other is mateh that, again, we just now saw last week, and that was the mateh of Aaron. But over here we have perhaps a little bit of a hint, and we'll be very clear about this soon, about which mateh was supposed to be taken. And speak to the rock in front of their eyes, and will give its water. And then you go and take water from the rock, and you shall give to drink to the congregation and to the flock. Which, by the way, should be reminiscent of perhaps Rivka, right? She gives water to the guests and water to the camels. So this is the same kind of behavior, and we've seen this a number of times, and that's what is supposed to be done. V'ikach Moshe et ha-mateh mi-lifnei Hashem, and Moshe takes the mateh mi-lifnei Hashem. So again, we now have a lifnei Hashem, right from in front of God. But this lifnei Hashem now, or this moment this description of the mater really does tell us which mater it was, because that means the one that was placed in front of was Aaron's mater. And just to make sure that we're not confused, it continues and it says, Kasher Tzivahu, as has been instructed or commanded, which means this is the right mater, which means that the mater which is taken is the mater of Aaron, that is the right one. It was put inside, which we'll need to look at in a moment. V'yikal Moshe v'Aaron et ha'kahal el p'nei ha'sela. They gather Moshe and Aaron. So again, it's interesting because Aaron was not included in all this, although it was his mater. They gather the people in front of the rock. V'yomer lahem, shimuna ha'morim. And they say, listen, you rebellious people. Amin ha'sela zenotzila chamayim. Will we get water from the rock? V'yor Moshe et yado. Moshe lifted his hands. V'yachet ha'sela b'matehu pamayim. And Moshe hits the rock with the staff twice. And a great deal of water came out, and again, the people and the animals had what to drink. Moshe says, God says to Moshe and Aaron, because you didn't believe in me to sanctify me in front of the eyes of the children of Israel, you're not going to bring this generation to the land which I've given them. Which is also very, very strong. The land is to Am Yisrael, and therefore you've separated yourself from Am Yisrael, and therefore you're not going in, and they are going in. And this is the Meir Bivah, where the people, Ravut B'nei Yisrael, where the people, again, quarreled or fought with God, and they were sanctified there. And there's a whole bunch of questions that come up, and some of them are the ones that maybe we or others have considered many, many times, but I really do want to go in what I think is going to end up being a slightly different direction, even though I'm going to quote some sources which I think are very, very central. The people are wrong because they quarreled. Nonetheless, the people will continue and Moshe won't. So, of course, this leads all the commentaries scurrying about to try to figure out, so what was it that Moshe did wrong? And you can have them. Some say that it was his anger that was wrong, and some are going to say that it was hitting the rock that was wrong, and some are going to say the words that he spoke which are wrong, and some will say a combination of those, and we'll have other possibilities as well. And on the other hand, the people sound to be guilty of sinning, but they continue on, because the people are the ones who quarrel with God. Nonetheless, I do want to stress that these people, with their quarreling, are nonetheless fundamentally different from other quarrelings that we've had because of this God consciousness, because it's Lefnei Hashem. Why didn't we die Lefnei Hashem? And why did you do this to Kahal Hashem? And therefore, despite everything, there is this sense of peoplehood, and there's this sense of being God's people, which is very, very important, even though they're God's people. You know, you can come out and say, okay, this is our wonderful, stiff-necked people who are quarreling with God, but they know who they are. We're God's people. And God ends up saying, yeah, you guys get the land, and Moshe doesn't. And again, there's just something over here which doesn't seem to work. Now, what I said was between the lines is that this sounds somehow connected to the previous parsha, specifically in source number 2, which you don't have, Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Kaf Aleph. Ve'deber Moshe b'nei Yisrael v'nuei lav kol nesiim. So this is at the end of the Korach episode, where all of them are then to take their staffs, and they do the staff competition. And Aaron's then ends up winning, Mateh Aharon. They put them all in the Ohel Ha'edut as testimony. Ve'yimi machrat v'yavo Moshe el Ohel Ha'edut. This is Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. And the next day, ve'yihinei parach Mate Aaron Levet Levi. Vayetse Perach Vayetse Tzitz Vayigmol Shkedim. And Aaron's alone is the one that flowers and almonds grow from his staff, and therefore this proves Aaron's superiority and selection and being chosenness. Vayetse Moshe et kol ha'matot lefnei Hashem al kol b'nei Yisrael v'yuvechu ish mateu. And each one then went, identified, and took their own staff. And then God says, okay, take Aaron's mateh and put it back in the place, the mishmeret, to a place to be saved, la'ot, as a sign, levnei Mary, for the children who are rebellious. Moshe did as he was commanded. So if we follow, and again, part of the problem is our perceived 39 years. And I just want to point something out, which, and I'm going to say this maybe in a couple of levels. One is, I have always imagined that Parshat You know, like Rashi told us, right here is the break-off point. Okay? Second comment. One of the challenges, and again, many times we've gone through this, one of the challenges in the book of Bamidbar is to try to understand the connections between the narrative and the laws which are presented. In the beginning of Parashat Chukot, we have a law, which is the law of the Paraduma. So why is the Paraduma presented at this particular point? So I think I did say, that the idea of the Paraduma is wonderful when we realize that that 39 years have gone by, all these people have died, a whole generation has passed away, so we really do need this law of Paraduma at this point. So this is the perfect time for it to be presented. So again, just pause there for a moment. Nonetheless, Paraduma comes as this breaking point between Korach and Chukat, which means the beginning of Chukat, but it comes right between those two parshiot. But what, however, if the idea of the Paraduma really should be connected more towards last week? Because again, we know that the parsha divisions are also somewhat artificial. The chapters are artificial. The parsha divisions are artificial. But maybe it's really a conclusion of there, because a lot of people died last week. Of course, you know, you have Korach, Nadav, and Avihu. And on top of that, you have 250. But on top of that, another 14,000, what was it, 14,700 people who also perished. So along the way over here, you're at 15,000, more or less. That's a lot of people who passed away. So right after that, to present the Parah Aduma maybe also makes a certain amount of sense. But do you realize what we just now have done? Okay? Linguistically and thematically, we've connected the sin of Moshe over here, which we've been saying 39 years later, and I really don't want to get into that anymore. Who said the episode of Korach took place 39 years later? I'm just saying, I know that we like to believe that, it's presented right after the Meraglim. So what's in our minds? In our minds, as the Meraglim takes place, the people now have lost hope, and this is the perfect time for a person like Korach to come in and say, you know, the people are hopeless now, let's go and try to replace the leadership. And there is a great deal of logic in that. I'm just pointing out that no time frame is given at all. So you can also make the argument that the episode of Korach happens 5 years later, or 10 years later, or 20 years later, or 30 years later. We have no idea exactly when it does take place. There's no time frame which is given. So therefore, it's sometime between the Meraglim episode and between the end of the 39 years. Exactly where along the way? So I'm just going to be honest now. I have no idea. Well, I'll be very honest. You have no idea when it takes place. Yes, we're told by Rashi, and I'm stressing that in this week's parsha, that now we've reached the end of the 39 years. Now we've reached the 40th year. And that seems absolutely correct. Why? Because now Miriam dies and now Aaron dies, and there's a whole bunch of chronology issues that work in that way. So absolutely correct. I mean, again, Rashi doesn't need my approval, but I'm saying absolutely, that makes sense that we're the 40th year. I just don't know where we were last week. When I say last week, I don't know where we were in Parshat Korach, and I don't have to take an either or. Either it was in the second year, or it was in the 39th year, because obviously, or 40th year, because obviously it could have been at any point in between. But what again I'm trying to get to is that when I look at this section over here, where Moshe is told go back and take the staff, and which staff is it that he's told to take? It's Aaron's staff. And how do I know it's Aaron's staff? And the truth is, I didn't know. But I know that it's Aaron's staff because we're told that he takes it Milifnei Hashem, and that was part of the theme over here. Oh, if we only died Lifnei Hashem, which means they seem to be referring to the episode of Korach and the 250 people and their death. Had we only died Lifnei Hashem like they did, so I'm saying that's very interesting. So therefore, here you have the echoes of the rebellion of Korach, and Moshe said, told, go take the staff in front of God. But why was the staff placed in front of God? It's and again, that, this is in Perek Yud Zayin Pasuk Kaf Hey, and you put it there, you're going to put it back as a sign for these children who are rebellious. So therefore, if Moshe is told to take the staff, and then Moshe articulates afterwards, and he hits the rock, and again, he was not told to hit it, but is the problem the hitting, is the problem the anger, is the problem what he said? What is it that he says to the people? He says, Shimuna Hamorim. And you look and say, well, where did he get that from? Listen, you rebellious people. Well, he got it from God, because God told him to take the staff whenever there's going to be a rebellious people, you take the staff as a sign. So he took the staff as a sign, and he is addressing him this way. And this connection that I'm saying now, which should be an obvious connection to all of us, and again, in a larger thematic sense, we've already been connected to the episode of Korach in terms of the Lifnei Hashem, to die Lifnei Hashem. In terms of the specific symbols involved and words being used, linguistic connection, it's the use of the staff, and it is the use of that line, we're rebellious people, which takes us absolutely right back to last week's parasha and to Korach, and therefore, again, to see Chukat as a continuation of Korach should not be all that difficult. Now, who is it that makes this connection that I'm saying? So the truth is, a number of the Rishonim say it, but I don't have to go that late, because it's already found in some early sources, including Midrash Rabbah, and including in the Midrash Tanayim, which is the Midrash Halacha. So this you don't have, but I'm going to read to you. It's going on a pasuk in Devarim, which hopefully we also recognize. Beginning of Parshat Ve'etchanan. V'tchananan Hashem be'etihi le'mor. Moshe says, I pleaded to God at that moment. Hashem elokim ata chilota larot et avdecha, et gadlcha ve'et yadcha chazaka, asher mikel b'shamayim uva'aret asher yaseka maser gvoratecha. So the Midrash says, on the Pasuk in Dvarim Perek Gimel, Hashem elokim ata chilota, amar lefanav ribonu shel olam, master of the universe, lama eini nechnas la'aretz. Why can't I go into the land of Israel? Mipnei she'amarti shimuna hamorim? Is it because I said shimuna hamorim? Now, this is very interesting, because over here in the Midrash, it clearly associates, of all the things that took place and transpired during that quote-unquote sin of Moshe, it's saying, okay, what's the problem? That I said shimuna hamorim? Which means, here the Midrash says, no, yeah, that's the problem, is that Moshe spoke in a way which was inappropriate to speak. I could say he should not have spoken about Am Yisrael that way. He should not have used that kind of language. And he says, okay, is the problem that I've said this? Or he's just taking this as a fact, that that's the problem. But then in the words of the Midrash, Moshe turns around and sort of points out to God, remember over here, right, Chanan al Hashem Beit Hilimor, Ata HaChilota, you're the one who started. So I'm going back to the Midrash. Why can't I go to Aretz? Mipnei shamarti shimuna marim. Atahu shamarta tchila l'mishmeret lot b'nei Mary. You're the one who said it first. Which means if the problem is that I'm calling them a rebellious people, you're the one who first called them a rebellious people. And the truth is I can strengthen this argument, because not only are you the one who called them that, you're the one who told me to go and take, you know, you that's a sign. That's an ot l'bnei Mary. That's going to be a sign for when people are rebellious. Take the staff, use it as a sign. So I took it like you told me to take it. And I addressed them as being a rebellious people. So what exactly is the problem over here? How can you punish me for doing essentially what you've done and what you've commanded me to do? So I hope you all realize that's a very good argument. The Midrash continues along the way over here. Other questions by Moshe why he can't go in, but we'll stop at that point. I'm just telling you that there's a lot more to that Midrash. The Rashbam, either on his own or more likely by being familiar with Chazal, writes, Vayomer lahem shmuna hamorim, listen, you know, you rebellious people, kimosha mataze sheyesh bashkedim mochiach shehu lemishmeret lot b'nei Mary. Why, notice the miraculous things that just took place, because look at this staff, it's the one with the almonds on it. Realize that God does the miraculous, which is also very interesting, because then the use of the staff is in order to show that God can make water come out of the rock. So using this particular staff was actually part of the message. The Chizkuni says this a little bit stronger, I think. Kachat amateh shel Aharon. So first of all, it clarifies us and says, this is Aaron's mateh. Dehotichtiv v'yikach Moshe tamateh milifnei Hashem. Because Aaron's is the one that was lifnei Hashem, which again, I'm reminding you, is one of the themes. V'zo maklos shel Aaron kedichtiv b'parashat Korach, heshivet mateh Aaron lifnei ha'idul mishmeret lo b'nei Mary. V'ot maklos shel Aaron ha'ya'ot lifnei Mary v'yita d'amar Moshe shemuna hamorim. So he's, again, it's just tying this together and saying, so Moshe really said exactly what God had instructed him to say. V'kfar ta'am Moshe she'amar lo Kadosh Baruch Hu kachat amateh savar Moshe lahakot basela v'Kadosh Baruch Hu lo omar kachat amateh elefi she'lo aya la'ot b'nei Mary. And Moshe's mistake was he thought he was supposed to hit it. But still, I'm just saying is that we've gotten so much, you know, closer to what it was. I mean, Moshe, if the problem is hitting it, so then it's harder. If the problem is taking this and speaking to the B'nai Israel and saying you're rebellious people, so then it causes us a little bit to question exactly what was the problem. There's a commentary which is called the Siftei Kohen. It's generally a little more Kabbalistic than some of the commentaries that we see. He was a student of Rav Yosef Karo. And he says that when he hits the rock, shows you that he really wanted to hit them. Okay, so that gets, I don't want to say a little scary, but that's, he's not the only one who reads that into it. But he continues and he says something which is very interesting, and those of you who are very good at diktuk will decide what you think of it. When God punishes Moshe, Vayomer Hashem Moshe Ve'el Aaron, Ya'an lo he'emantem bi. So he's troubled what the he over there is in that word, he'emantem bi. And he writes as follows. He says, lo amar amantem bi, that you didn't have emunah, ela he'emantem bi. So he says, he'emantem lachnis b'liban shi Yisrael, sheyesh bo yechol l'shenot ha'teva b'lishum torach. That he did not give them, he'emantem, is that you did not give the emunah over to them. That's the way that he understands that. And he says the whole episode, the whole issue of leaving Egypt along the way was to give them this belief that the Jews can do all kinds of things when God is on their side, including eventually entering into the land of Israel. Look, I agree with you. I mean, at the end of the day, we want to try to get away from interpretations that ends up with what we would have called as kids, Simon Says. Okay, you did the right thing, but you didn't say Simon Says. I mean, God told him, take this. And right. So what's the Kedusha over here? So let me pause for a second, and I will truly try to get back to the point that I'm up to right now. But I want to take a little bit of a detour, just in order to make things maybe a little bit tighter. So, oh good, I'm up to number 10, which is Perek Tet Zayin. Now, if we're already going back to the Korach episode, there's something which Korach says which may be incredibly important. And we were never sure, is this completely cynical? Is there any truth involved in this? Is this just, his PR machine? Is it a soundbite? But one of the things that Korach does is he gathers the people together, Vekula Opene, El Moshe El Aaron, Vimaleim, Rav Lachem, Kikola Eida Kulam Kedoshim Uvutacham Hashem. Everybody is holy and God is within all of them. If you think about it, part of the problem of saying Shimu Nahem Orim, listen you rebellious people, is because you're taking away from the Jewish people and you're accusing them of being rebellious people. And part of what Korach is saying, don't disrespect Am Yisrael. Am Yisrael are holy people, God is within them. Now the truth is that everything that Korach said is true. Yes, kol ha'eda kulam kedoshim uvetocham Hashem, that's true. The only problem with Korach then is, okay, so now what's the conclusion based on that? But it's, and those of you not sure what I'm doing right now, this is really the issue. If Parshat Chukat follows Parshat Korach, we need to see how it flows a little bit better. Which means all that I've connected so far were a couple of specific terms. One was this term of Lefnei Hashem, which I think is very strong. Had we only died Lefnei Hashem. The other thing is the use of the Mateh, Shemuna Hamorim, B'nei Meri. All of that should absolutely convince us that there's some kind of a continuation over here. So then what am I really doing? I just want to fill in the other pieces that maybe didn't look like they fit in. So one piece is Korach's starting point, is everybody is holy. So is part of the problem over here of Moshe, again, what's the name of the place going to be called? Kadesh, holiness. What's the problem over here is that you did not do the Kedusha. There's a lack of Kedusha over here. Now, maybe I'm going too far. Maybe there's a lack of recognition of these people being holy, and now I'm going back to what I said before. These are people who do have God consciousness. These are people who are speaking about God. So therefore, to completely call them rebellious, okay, there are times that we've been rebellious. So who are you saving that rebellious term for? Is the rebellious term going to be saved for people who have rejected God, who don't see God in their lives, who don't see God's hand in history? Is it the people who are idolaters? People, which means this is an interesting use. Nonetheless, who's to blame over here? You can easily blame God, because God is the one who said, go and take the Mateh. And that's what leads Moshe there. But so I'm pointing out is that this instance really seems to be the argument of Korach that this is a holy people and God is within them. Yes, these people by Kadesh are a holy people and God is within them. So I'm saying that that's what's a little more interesting than I think that we ever would have noticed before. Second point. Of course, Parshat Chukat is called Parshat Chukat because of the major chok which is introduced. And that major chok, of course, is the chok which we call, is the chok which we call the Para Aduma. Now, before I get to the Para Aduma, now I want to, again, make this a little bit tighter. When it says, V'yikach Korach, Korach took. So what is it that he took? And we discussed this a little bit last week, because the word took is a difficult word, because what did he take? So it says he made a machloket. But at least in the Midrash, there's this one theme that he actually takes something and he presents it, and that thing that he takes is a beged shekulo tchelet. Vayikach Korach, so what does he take? And that's where that Midrash came from, because it had to try to figure out what does he take. So again, those of you who are the sources, it's number 11. Vayikach Korach, what did it say right before? This maktiv lamala minyan vasulam tzitzit. Kafatz Korach v'mar l'moshe talit shekulo tchelet ma'oshet yeh p'turah minan tzitzit. If somebody takes a talit which is all tchelet, doesn't need a string or two strings, which, or one long string, which has tchelet in it. And Moshe says yes, and therefore people start to laugh. And then the continuation of there, he took a Sefer Torah and says, if you have a house which is full of a Sefer Torah, does it need one little parchment on the door? And Moshe says, yes, and they all start to laugh and say that this is comical. Now, many, many years ago, Rabbi Soloveitchik spoke about this later on. This was written as well. And he labeled the Korach rebellion as a common sense rebellion. He said, halacha is a science, and science doesn't always work by easily predictable, intuitive rules, which means sometimes they're complex rules. And specifically over here within the science of halakha, he said, you know, the logical, I mean, I can give you examples of this. For example, if there is a kohen who's has a mum, right, some kind of blemish, and can't serve in the Beit HaMikdash, and served anyway, the korban is absolutely not considered to be kosher. Okay, that's the halakha. If a kohen has a son through a wife that he was not allowed to marry, okay, that child is considered to be a halal. He's not a kohen. And I'll say it again, he's just not a kohen. If the halal served in the Beit HaMikdash and brought a korban, the korban is kosher. Nobody here could have predicted that in terms of logic, in terms of halakha. Because you would have said the opposite, that the kohen who has a blemish is considered to be a kohen. Okay, he has a blemish, so then maybe there's a technical problem why he shouldn't work, but he's a kohen. The kohen who is the son of the person who's the son of a kohen who's not a kohen is a halal. He's not a kohen. I mean, the first one is not allowed to go into a cemetery. Why? Because he's a kohen. A kohen with a blemish, he can't go in a cemetery. The second one can go into a cemetery. Why? Because he's not a kohen. So who here could have predicted that b'di'evid, that person's korban counts and that person's korban doesn't count? So I will just say it right now, Korach and his friends could not have predicted that, because that doesn't follow logic. And Korach's rebellion is one of logic. And logic would dictate that if I need one blue string, well, what if I have a garment made out of thousands of blue strings? I certainly don't need another blue string. And there's a certain amount of logic in this. So therefore, halacha doesn't always work by logic, and therefore you actually need experts in the area of halacha in order to determine halacha. And the things that Rabbi Soloveitchik said when he said this in the early 1970s are probably at least as important, if not more important today, compared to when he actually had said it. But now let's keep in mind, what is the beginning of Parashat Chukat about? The beginning of Parashat Chukat is about the Parah Aduma. So now what do you know about the Parah Aduma, which now seems absolutely relevant in terms of all this? Parah Aduma is the thing that there's no logic whatsoever. So if there's no logic whatsoever, isn't that now going to actually be the perfect, I don't know, antithesis to Korach's rebellion, basically saying, but we understand halacha, we understand how these things work, and based upon logic, again, I should be a kohen, he should be a kohen, and so on and so forth. You can't even figure out, again, I'm just saying, in terms of the laws of kohen, the case I just now presented, in terms of the kohen with the mum versus the halal, you couldn't have predicted that. So how can you go and use pure logic in order to try to predict what are the rules of the spiritual universe, which I think is really the issue. When it comes down to the laws of the Parah Aduma, there are spiritual rules that we would not have been able to predict. Part of the issue is going to be is that the person who was tame becomes tahar, the person who was tahar becomes tame within the process over here of the preparation of it. So again, I would have thought that if I'm involved in something which is a purifying process, a tahor process, I would have thought that everybody who's touching this tahor process becomes tahor along the way. So I'm going to say it again. Who would have been able to predict this? So therefore, the placing of the Parah Aduma following the Korach rebellion, and I'm throwing everything back at us now, right? Everything. Yeah, it's Korach, and it's Datin, and it's Aviram, and it's 250, and it's the 14,700. It's all those people that die. And it's the whole generation of 39 people die. But placed right between those two issues, right? The 15,000 people died and all the other people who die along the way in the desert. Right between them is this Parsha Chukat of the Parah Aduma is placed right there. I'm going to say it again, and that becomes really a perfect placing for it in the sense that it's also a response to Korach and not just, okay, here's something that you can't figure out. The Midrash, which those who have our sources in Source 13, it tells us that there are certain rules of halacha that one could not have predicted. And it says that actually the Satan or the Yetzer Hara, Rashi cites this in a certain way, picks on us because saying, you know, how do these things work? I mean, it's interesting that there's an idea of shatnez, right? Right? You can't wear wool and linen together. So one of the rules that breaks, one of the laws that breaks that rule is going to be the law of the clothing of the Kohen. Another law that breaks that rule is the tzitzit itself. When you are going to put the two colors, they're going to have wool and linen gathered together, and it's allowed to do that. I'm not saying, right, it's allowed to do that, which also goes to this whole subtext that once they're told they're allowed to wear this clothing, essentially they're saying that everybody has the status of a Kohen, so if everybody has the status of Kohen, then everybody's holy. I'm just trying to show how the laws of tzitzit could have led to this comment of Korach, well, everybody's holy, v'bitocham Hashem, because everybody's allowed to basically wear Kohen clothing. Everybody's a Mamlechet Kohen and Vagoy Kadosh because everybody's wearing this colorful type of clothing, which maybe is reminiscent to us a little bit of the coat of many colors. And we then at least wonder out loud, what was it that Yaakov was trying to communicate to Yosef at that time? Is it that he's trying to say to him that you will one day become the Kohen because you're my real firstborn, and therefore he's giving him the coat of many colors, which therefore would be some type of a pre-Kohen or Kohen Gadol type of clothing? Or is he saying is that this is the clothing of kings and I'm really making you Amlechet Goyim Goy Kadosh? So again, I wonder out loud about that. Nonetheless, I'll say it again, finding the laws of the Parah Aduma right here make it more interesting, which then leads me to something else, which is a teaching which is found, those of you who have our sources, it's number 14. It's a book which is called Torah Tamincha. It's written by a Rav Yaakov ben Rav Chananel. His name in Hebrew they call it Skili, which most likely he was from Italy, most likely he was from Sicily. So that's most likely who he is or where he's from. He was a student of the Rajba, again, who lived in Spain. And so this is Spain around the 14th century. So I'm going to read to you a little bit from this teaching. And it's going to take it to another place that maybe we don't anticipate this going. First of all, it's going back to that midrash that we saw in Ve'etchanan, where Moshe complains to God and says, hold it, you spoke this way first. Why, when I speak this way, there's a problem and I can't go into the land of Israel? So the headline over here is, Lama lo zacha Moshe Rabbeinu likanes l'eretz Yisrael levnot Beit HaMikdash? Why could Moshe not have gone into the land of Israel and build the Beit HaMikdash? And it starts off, Amar lefanav, why have you declared and punished me with death? If it's because I've said about your children, listen, you rebellious. You also called them rebellious. Although, you know, even though I've said this around six times already, you can still say there's a difference. God has the prerogative of saying certain things, and we can't always say the same things that God can say. You're the one who started this, and again, that goes off of that verse in Ve'etchanan. And Moshe then engages God in conversation, and it was, as it were, as if two friends were involved in a discussion, a debate. You know, is the only reason you really want to go in is to build the Beit HaMikdash? And then God continues and says, and this is something we've learned before, Imata bone oto lo achrivenu lolam. And he says, God says to Moshe, you should know that if you build it, it will never be destroyed. Amar lefanav v'lav ye'utu. And Moshe says back to God, isn't that a good thing? So now, again, I said from the very beginning, you remember, what are the things you would warn about? Warn Moshe, don't do whatever you did. If it's being angry or talking or hitting, don't do it. Because if you don't do this, this is the implication. You're going to go into the land of Israel. You're going to build a Beit HaMikdash. And that Beit HaMikdash is going to last forever. So how much does Jewish history change with that one particular, you know, you want to send that letter back and say, Moshe, don't do this. But here, Moshe is being told, but if you go in, that's what's going to happen. And he says to God, isn't this a good thing? Amrle, God says to Moshe, Ukish Yisrael chotim lefanai yacher apai behem v'achalem. He goes, but then what's going to happen? When Israel sin, I'm going to get mad at them and I'm going to swallow them up. V'im yivne al yidei acher, but if somebody else builds the Beit HaMikdash, v'yicher api, and I get upset with them, az eshpochet chamati ala itzim v'alavanim. Then I will take out my anger on stuff, on rocks and on sticks and on a building, and I'll destroy the building, but the patient will be saved. The people will be saved. And this is a midrash which is found in Midrash Eicha. V'achle beiti v'lo achle banai. And I will swallow my house and not my children. So God is saying is that there are times that the people, by the way, it's interesting, it's a time that they're going to be a B'nai Meri. There's going to be times that they're going to be rebellious. And when they're going to be rebellious, what exactly should be the response? Now, the reason why this is so interesting, because along the way, the Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, that we've met and that we've loved, is the Moshe who argues after the golden calf. And God says, I'm going to destroy them, make you a nation. Moshe is absolutely not, you know, absolutely not. Or after the Meraglim, where God says again to Moshe, I'll destroy them and make you a nation. So now again, God is saying that I'll destroy them. By the way, there's no other offer on the table. I'll destroy them. And is that what you want? Now, of course, we know it's not what Moshe wants. Nicha lacha shetikanes la'aretz v'achala et Yisrael? Do you think it's a good idea that you'll go into the land of Israel, but the Jewish people will one day be destroyed? Im nicha lacha hikanes. If this is something which is convenient for you, then go ahead. Vim lav alei umot bahar. But if it's not, then make the decision and go up to the mountain and you'll die there. Now, this is such a powerful teaching. And as I said, he weaves together, you know, two different midrashim. V'haynu d'chtiv v'yitaber Hashem bi lama'anchem. And that's why it says that God got upset with me for your sake. Lama'anchem, for your sake. Lama'anchem v'lo lama'ani. K'dei shelo l'chalot etchem b'sha shetechatu. In order that you not be destroyed at the moment that you sin. That even though Moshe was decreed with death, b'mei mirivat kadesh, he mivatla ilma shirichem Yisrael. That even though the God, I mean, you always would wonder the question, why could not God forgive Moshe for this? So he says, no, he could have. And he offered him. He said, if you want to be forgiven, you're forgiven, you go into the land of Israel, and Moshe doesn't accept it because he realizes the price is too high. That Moshe at that moment got to the point of absolute perfection. And at that moment he understood the thoughts of the Creator of all. Whoever understands this understands the secrets. And the secret of things, even the angels don't understand. And I want to go back a second to all kinds of midrashim that we skipped today, that we had on the paper, in terms of the Chukat HaTorah. The Chukat HaTorah, in terms of the Chok, is the Paraduma. Because paraduma makes no sense. Paraduma brings purity and to impurity and impurity to purity, and it doesn't seem to make any logical sense. On another level, we can say the thing that makes no logical sense is death, and death is this ultimate situation where a person has to just put their head down and accept the decree of God. And it's interesting that the procedure which is used is unfathomable, when actually death is the thing which is unfathomable. The Midrash goes on, and it says, and this is a long Midrash about how there was once a man named Shlomo HaMelech who prayed for wisdom, and it goes on to say that he understood everything. He understood this and this and all kinds of secrets of the world. But the Midrash ends, there was one secret that he could not understand, and that was the Paraduma. He goes, that was beyond him. He could not understand it. And then right after that, the Midrash comes back, and it says, and I am, if those of you have the sources, I'm on page 3, which is Midrash Rabbah Yutet Vav. V'chu elecha paraduma, it's on the bottom of page 3. V'chu elecha paraduma, amar Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, amar l'Kadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe, lecha ani magale et tam para, aval la'acher chuka. To you, I explain the secrets, but to everyone else, it's a mystery, which means that we just now understood something, and I hope we understood something, is that what transpires within this episode of take the staff, because this is going to be a sign for the rebellious people. But it is a sign for the rebellious people. Which rebellious people? Not just the rebellious people that are standing in front of Moshe at that particular time. It's a sign for rebellious people who are going to exist throughout the generations, because essentially this is what's taking place over here. And again, if you think I'm reading too far into this, just pay attention to what just now has happened. Nobody understands the paraduma because there's an inverse relationship between Tuma and Tahara, except for one person who does understand it. And that one person is Moshe. And Moshe understands now the secret of the paraduma. And I'm saying part of that secret is that sometimes death is preferable to life. And let me go back for a second. Moshe is really the one who's Tahor, and the people are really the ones who are Tameh. Moshe is the one who's going to die, and the people are the ones who are going to be saved. That what we have over here in the situation by Kadesh is a situation of paraduma. Yes? Do you all understand what I'm saying? Where the inverse has just now transpired. We're the ones, therefore, who were Tameh and rebelled. They're the ones who are now going to be saved. And the one who was Tahor, he's now the one who's going to have to die. And that's the Tumah of death is going to come upon Moshe. Now, in case you're going to say, hold it, how did that just now happen? Well, Moshe had a choice. Because now Moshe understands the secret. Moshe understands that Am Yisrael needs to lose certain things to be able to continue. And that's a very difficult sentence. I mean, ultimately, the whole purpose of the Beit HaMikdash was to bring about Kapara. Bring about atonement. So who would have imagined that the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash will be the ultimate act of atonement? Should I say that again? The destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is the ultimate act of atonement, because then we get to this point that Am Yisrael will be destroyed. Okay, but there's a building that we can give instead. God will take the building, which means that the building is better than any korban that was ever offered within the building. Because the korban saved the Jew in this particular case or that particular case or that particular case. And now we've come to a point that the Jews are rebellious. B'nai Meri. The Jews are rebellious, and God says, okay, I can take the people, I can take the building. He takes the building, the people survive. Which means that the purpose of the Beit HaMikdash is to bring about atonement. But I'm just saying in a way that maybe we never understood. But the building could have stayed. In order for the building to have stayed, so Moshe could have stayed. So now you realize that Moshe is also there for the atonement of the people. So now the choice is, do we keep Moshe but we lose the patient, or do we keep the patient and do we lose Moshe? Which means Moshe understands, and that's what was so interesting in this source, in this Torah Tamincha, by telling us that Moshe understands the secrets of the universe now. He understands the secrets. He understands this reversal. He understands this inverse relationship. He understands the paraduma. He understands how something which is Tahor now will be struck by Tumat Met. And that's him. That's Moshe. Which means when I said that Moshe, the Midrash says that Moshe understands this in a deeper way than any of you ever understood. That Moshe ends up walking up to the mountain by himself, laying down and dying, and God burying him in order for Am Yisrael to be able to survive. Because when it comes down to it, and I'm saying this in the most ironic way, that Korach is correct, that everybody is holy and God is within them. But in order for us to remain, and being that we are also a B'nai Meri, which means that's true, but we're also B'nai Meri. Now, how do we reconcile those two points? How do we reconcile as being a holy people, nonetheless being B'nai Meri? So God understands this. And therefore, God can say they're going to need a sign. They're going to need a sign of holiness. They're going to need the matet. They're going to need a sign that miracles can take place. They also understand that something else is true. And this other thing which is true is that they don't know exactly how it works, because it seems quite magical and mystical in terms of this working of the paraduma. But ultimately, the secret of the paraduma is within the person of Moshe. That's why this place is called Kadesh. This place is a holy place. Something very holy took place over here. Am Yisrael was saved right now at this place. And you're going to say, hold it, how was Am Yisrael saved? Because I just said, you know, by the way, this goes back to this point of sending the letter. Send the letter to Moshe Rabbeinu, don't hit the rock so you can go into the land of Israel. Okay, so then, as I said, so we saved the building, but we lost the patient. So who wants to go back and play with history? And because you don't know about the consequences. You don't know how things are going to end up working out afterwards. You don't know what's going to be when you save this and what the price may be. So now we realize, okay, and this is maybe the most important thing, you know, other than I think the really specific point, but the most important thing is that Parshat Chukat is not separate from Parshat Korach. There is a flow between them. And I hope that now has become obvious. Starting from their words, the Lefnei Hashem, had only died like the people there died Lefnei Hashem, in terms of God saying to Moshe, go take the staff from in front of God. In That may not have been instruction. That's what he did. He took it, Milifnei Hashem. Going on to the use of the phrase, Levnei Mary, but going all the way back to Korach's claim from the very beginning of these people being holy, and then throwing in the middle of all this the Para Aduma, which there really becomes the division, in a sense, between the two Parshiot, but that's also part of it. Because as much as Korach can think that everything makes perfect sense, well, you don't understand things very well, because that's not how God works, that's not how Halacha works, that's not how the spiritual universe works. There are going to be rules which are going to be counterintuitive, and one of the greatest rules which is counterintuitive is, in fact, the Para Aduma. But once we understand the counterintuitiveness, we can begin to understand this decision that Moshe had to make, and that decision was, will the Beit HaMikdash serve, ultimately, as an act of atonement, I say as an act of atonement in its destruction, or will the Beit HaMikdash survive, but will lose the people along the way? And Moshe realizes that that can't possibly be, and the Jewish people need to survive, even when they are a B'nai Meri, even when they are people who are rebellious. But in order for that to happen, then we need this transformation to take place, and therefore these people who are in fact rebellious need to survive, and the people who are Tamei need to become Tahar. But in order for that to happen, then the person who's the most Tahar needs to become connected to Tumat Mate, and that's Moshe Rabbeinu, who's now going to die, and the Tumat Mate will come upon him, but at least Am Yisrael will survive.